Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning, it's all things political, and we're going to take a look at what's developing with the capture of one of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects and the death of another. And then if there's time, we will check in on what's next with immigration reform. And it may well be that the bombing changes a lot of things, but I'm going to go ahead. We're having trouble getting our guest on the line. Excuse me. So I'm going to go ahead and open the phone lines now, and let's find out what you want to talk about right away. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. And we are waiting to find out whether we have that guest on the line. And what do you think? What are your most burning questions about the Boston Marathon shooting? And we've got the suspect in the hospital now and finding out what we will learn. We're finding out what's going to happen with the Miranda rights. And let's see if we've got our guest on the line. And that would be great if we do. David Swerdlick, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you, Veronica?
I'm excellent. So I'm going to introduce you now that we have you on the line. We have David Swerdlick with us. He covers national politics for TheRoot.com and is a part of Washington Post Digital as well. And we're asking listeners, you know, what their biggest questions are, because there are a lot of them out there right now. And listeners, you can keep on calling in. I know lots of us have questions on our minds. 1-800-642-1234. And obviously, David, huge news last week. Our whole staff at WPR was watching the manhunt in Boston, and the country was watching, too. Where are we now?
Well, I think, you know, it's this one week later time frame where, as a country, as the political set, as the law enforcement community are all sort of waking up a week later, you know, the dust has settled, people have had a chance to digest this, and now is, you know, a little less shock and a little more of, okay, what does this all mean, right? So you've, as you just laid out, you've got really three issues here. One is the why did this happen? Is there more to this plot that we don't yet know about? Then there's the sort of legal aspect of do we handle this? Does law enforcement handle this as a criminal matter or put it under the treat the suspect as an enemy combatant? And then finally, I don't know if you want to go into this, but you know, then there's the aspect of, from my perspective, the politics, right? A lot happened last week, and a lot was sort of jumbled up and buried by the whole mixture of the Boston bombing, the fertilizer plant explosion, the poison attack on the White House mailroom, and then, you know, it's sort of like, okay, did that really all just happen in one week? And it's like, yeah, it did. We got to sort of regroup as a country and figure out, you know, what's going on.
Right. Well, let's start with the enemy combatant question right now, because there are those who are urging that we do go that route. What does that mean if we look at him as an enemy combatant?
Well, it would mean a couple of things. It would mean that the suspect, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, would be treated as not as a criminal in our regular judicial system, and not read Miranda rights, not given the same legal protections that a criminal defendant does, either in the federal judicial system or in a state judicial system. Potentially, it would mean he would be treated more like a suspect that say are some of the people that are being held in Guantanamo Bay. He'd be treated more as someone who we were at war with, as opposed to a criminal. And I know you have, you know, very sophisticated listeners in WPR, and so they're aware of the legal nuances to this. You know, I tend to come down on the administration so far has made the right call by going with the judicial system, just because it's been fairly effective up to this point in dealing with these kinds of cases. And you know, there's, I don't, other than the idea of the philosophical idea of treating terrorists with a foreign background as enemy combatants as part of the broader war on terror, I don't know that anyone has articulated a tactical advantage to not reading them their Miranda rights. I don't think anyone is saying Some are saying, but I don't know that there's any evidence yet that reading Miranda rights is going to jeopardize the investigation. The investigation's gone pretty effectively up to this point.
So in terms of whether or not he could face the death penalty, as I understand it, it looks like he'll be tried in federal court. And I'm wondering if the enemy combatant status would change that at all, or does that remain the same? Is it just more about the interrogation techniques that are involved?
To my knowledge, it's about the interrogation techniques. I actually, that's a good question. I actually don't know if the death penalty is available if they are treated as enemy combatants. As you said, because there's no death penalty in Massachusetts, the death penalty would only be available in a criminal prosecution if they were prosecuted federally, which I think that is the understanding of what's going to happen right now based on what the Justice Department is planning to do with the suspects. The thing, when you look at the defendant, this is all at the stage where this guy who's in custody, Jokhar Tsarnaev, is just the accused, but all signs are pointing to him having involvement in the plot, being one of the main people in the plot. And so, you look at it and you say, okay, you have this very strange set of circumstances, right, where he's a teenager, but he's not a kid, right? He's 19 years old. He's American, but he wasn't born here. And, you want to see it as somewhat of a gray area, but at the same time, it's, in another sense, you could look at it as very straightforward. An American on American soil planted a bomb, arrested by the FBI, now set to be prosecuted by the Justice Department. There's a case to be made that that because of his brother's ties to the former Russian areas of Chechnya and Dagestan, that there's an international terrorist component to it, and there may very well be. But at the same time, the judicial process that the Justice Department has done a pretty good job, I think, up to this point of prosecuting these types of cases in the judicial system. So we'll see what happens.
And another thing I want to talk about that I find interesting is it didn't take, more than a day, less than a day, before we started seeing, I guess, some kind of sympathetic responses to this younger brother, Jahar, painting him as someone who was possibly led around by the nose by his older brother, that the older brother may have been overly influential in Jahar's thinking. And, of course, Jahar is the one who's alive that we're dealing with. What do you make of these portraits of Jahar, and will they influence anything?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, just now they've been reporting this morning that Jahar has been communicating with interrogators by writing since he's apparently wounded in the neck, can't speak. He's undergoing interrogation by writing down answers to questions. So depending on the way questions are answered, depending on the information that investigators glean, he might wind up being portrayed as a more of a sympathetic character. But if we wind up knowing more definitively what we think we know now, that he was in fact one of the people planting bombs, I don't see how he comes off as much of a sympathetic character. I mean, at the end of the day, he's 19 years old is young, but that's an adult. And if he was led around by the nose by his older brother, it's not clear that's any kind of mitigating factor in terms of his guilt, or potential guilt in this kind of thing. I do think, though, you raise what is probably one of the more interesting aspects of this, which is people around the country, I think, have become accustomed to this idea that, as terrible as it is, as much as we don't want to become accustomed to it, there is a trend where we are periodically going to face these terrorist attacks. We are periodically going to have to be, as citizens, sort of keen to the fact that this could happen anywhere at any time. But at the same time, you look at a teenager who, like you said, people have come out and said, oh, he was a great kid, he was smart, he was funny, we all went to high school together, everybody liked him. And then you're just left saying, well, why? And I think that is, at some levels, a more penetrating question than whether he should be tried in civilian court or a military tribunal. The why goes to the real broad philosophical questions of this, for lack of a better term, this global war on terror. who are the sides, who are the people involved, what motivates them, and when does it all end, right? And that's I think what's going to be a more interesting question.
Well, let's go right to our callers. We've got lots of folks who called in already. So Jim is first in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wrote a little set piece about this called Droning On. And I'm sure if you go to Boston now, you'd see a lot of memorials with flowers and memorials and signs and things of this nature put out by decent, well-meaning people. But in a way, it's kind of a pile of garbage. And the reason I feel that way about it is that we have this ability to care and have empathy for the suffering of our people when horrible things are inflicted upon them, but we don't have a parallel corresponding concern about what we inflict on the world. And you know, in terms of the long run, we don't see the need to keep our nose out of other people's business and to stop exploiting other people for resources. And you can go back all the way to whatreallyhappened.com, talking about Jane's defense in Afghanistan. And we know that Milton Friedman said that we went into Iraq for oil, and of course there were resources in Afghanistan and the route for the pipeline at that point in time. And so the problem in all of this is that we don't have empathy when we act out in the world so that we can control the world for its resources, and then. In America, and I'm not, I missed part of what the news was on just before the program started, but in America we have this problem that if we want to register people for their when they buy automatic weapons, we say that we're interfering with their freedom. But I wonder how do the families of the people that incurred all of this suffering feel about the freedom of these people to get assault weapons and to perpetrate this crime.
Jim, I take your point. Don't we need to have empathy all the time, though? You know, you're talking about issues over abroad the U.S., you say, sticking its nose in foreign business. But, I mean, the lesson is the same. We need to have empathy no matter what happens, and that certainly holds true for Boston, just as it does anywhere else in the world.
Well, my point is that we, if we had empathy for people overseas in terms of what we're doing, perhaps we wouldn't have incurred this suffering.
Can I jump in, please, David.
Yeah. So Jim, respectfully, I take a different view than you. I understand very well what you're saying, and I think your view is shared by a number of people on the political spectrum about whether or not there's a nexus between America's role in the world and then what happens here in terms of downstream effects. I think, though, that there's a couple of things. If you go back far enough historically, certainly you can find instances where the U.S. has been a bad actor, right? Let's say, in my view, the U.S. was a bad actor in invading and occupying Iraq. But at a certain point, I think it's pretty tough to say that, again, this is my view, that there's a strong nexus between saying, okay, something that happened X number of years ago under a different policy, under a different administration, we should expect or should, own the fact that that would lead downstream to an attack of any size in the U.S., whether it's foreign terrorism or domestic terrorism. I certainly don't think that a domestic terrorist would find justification in killing people for that act. When you talk about these particular suspects, if these turn out to be the guilty parties, you're talking about guys who essentially came to the United States, reaped the benefits of U.S. citizenship such as they are, but for them there was a disconnect between their status as Americans, or I guess the younger brother was an American, the older brother was trying to become an American, and then having an ideological disconnect potentially, with whatever their view of America was in the world. So I do understand what you're saying. And I do think, like Veronica said, there should be empathy for people suffering in any situation. People are the victims of violence in any situation. I'm not convinced that there would be that nexus could reasonably be drawn by these guys in this case.
All right. And Jim, we do appreciate your call. And we'll move to Mike. Mike joins us from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
I'm just trying to digest your previous caller's train of thought, but it doesn't matter. but going back to this other part about, you know, how he should be tried or this or that, or it seems to me that we overcomplicate things. I mean, this is pretty clear cut. You know, this guy did what he did. It's, you know, it's on film. Everybody saw it. Of course he should be tried. He should, you know, all of that. But we have to come up with something that is swift. It's got to be quick. It's got to be fast. I mean, this guy, Hassan, you know, in the Fort Hood shooting, he's still on trial, and it's been years.
Right.
It makes no sense.
Right. Well, that's a good point. The swiftness of the justice system needs to come into play, I suppose, for healing now and to get answers. But I don't know, David's word, like, how important do you think speed is?
Well, again, respectfully, I might take a slightly different view here. I understand the frustration when you have situations where it seems pretty apparent that a suspect is guilty. You know, you've got people on videotape. You've got no indication that they don't have the right guys in custody or the right individual in custody. Then why does it take years? I think the answer to that is that, you know, it's unsatisfying, but our justice system turns very slowly, no matter what the crime is, even if it has nothing to do with terror. If you're talking about serious capital crimes, you're talking about felonies, the justice system turns slowly, and I actually think it's a credit to our system that the wheels of the bureaucracy turn relatively slowly so that, you know, at least the people that are involved in prosecuting these cases have an opportunity to get it right. They don't always get it right, but I think they get it right a lot of the time, and they have an opportunity to do it. One political point about that, which is that, in my view, Veronica, the debate between enemy combatants, treating suspects in these situations as enemy combatants versus in a criminal prosecution, to me, there's a large political component to it as opposed to a legal component. Yes, there are those who really want to, you know, sort of zero in on what the constitutional implications of it are, and those are obviously crucial implications. But a lot of it, to my mind, is that you have politicians who want to project this idea of being tougher on terror than the other politician, and, you know, you don't want to question their motives. They may have very good reasons for saying, oh, this should be a criminal prosecution versus this should be, these suspects should be treated as enemy combatants. But unless there's some case being made that one or the other will not lead to an effective prosecution, some of it strikes me as posturing. In other words, you have, say, Senator Lindsey Graham was one of the first calling for this to be, for Jokhar Tsarnaev to be treated as an enemy combatant. Well, what does that mean? Is he going to be transferred to Guantanamo Bay? Is he going to be put up as a teenager who was going to junior college in Boston, going to be put before a military who, as far as we know, has not been back to his native country since he was a little kid? Is he going to be put up in front of a military court? I'm sure you could make a case for that, but I don't think a case has been made that there's something wrong with just prosecuting him in federal court. So I understand the frustration of your caller, but I think these things just proceed as they do. It would be worse if we found that our prosecution system was not getting the job done. At least in many cases, it's getting the job done, even if it's slowly and then, you know, unsatisfying in that regard.
You can understand the case for thoroughness, but is there a community cost when the wheels of justice move so slowly in terms of communities and families and in a country healing?
Certainly. I think not to oversimplify it, but there is a cost. People don't have that sense of closure sometimes. You look at the 9/11 victims. I mean, this is not exactly the same situation, but if you look at the most obvious case of Osama bin Laden, it was nearly a decade later that Osama bin Laden was, you know, located and killed by the U.S. government. You know, that probably did bring a sense of closure to many of the family members of the 9/11 victims, but it was a long time in coming. Again, this is we're talking about a prosecution, not a manhunt at this point anymore. But I think that the interest of the U.S. government is primarily in getting it right, not getting it done quickly to bring closure. In this case, at least, you know, this for what it's worth, there's closure in the sense that there, as far as we know, there aren't suspects at large at this point.
Well, we're talking this hour with David Swerdlick, who covers national politics at TheRoot.com, a part of Washington Post Digital. And it's All Things Political. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And, of course, our big story, what we're looking at is the latest developments in Boston. What's next as Jahar Tsarnaev is in the hospital in serious condition, starting to answer some questions on a notepad. Lots of questions still to be answered. We're wondering what the biggest questions are on your mind as we move forward with this. And maybe as we move along, we'll have a chance to look at the intersection of the Boston events and immigration reform that has started to be talked about as well. And you can reach us with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. Veronica Rickert with you today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn today on All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is David Swerdlick, who covers national politics for TheRoot.com, a part of Washington Post Digital. And we're talking right now about the Boston Marathon bombings and what that means going forward. And we'll take a look at maybe how it intersects with immigration reform as well as we go along. And next to our phone call, we have Earl joining us from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good topic for sure. I remember when I was in college many years ago, and then learned that the news and the press is essential to our democracy. And yet now we have diminished funds for news departments, especially in newspapers, also in radio and TV, and more commentators and the like, and social media. So it seems that structurally and financially, we're not backing a free press anymore, and we're not going to get enough information to make good decisions.
So can you draw out a little for me, Earl, how you see your critique of the media coming into play in Boston?
Well, it had plenty of commentators, for sure, and there was a feeding frenzy to get something, but you didn't have the detail people to get more information like that, and it just seemed underfunded or not coordinated enough to give us that information.
So you're saying you felt the weakening of newspapers, you felt the effects of that in the information we were getting.
Right. I'm just about to go out with the dog to get a morning paper. I walk a mile every morning. So to me, it's important to get the actual newspaper. But we see more and more social media and other ways that people get the news.
Well, that's an interesting point. Well, thank you, Earl, and good luck with the walk to get the paper with the dog.
In the rain,
as a lot of rain these days. Anyway, David, what do you think about Earl missing the newspapers, the power of papers?
Oh, I think he actually makes a good point. And in this case, I'll just point to myself as an example. I'm a political writer, but I typically write commentary. I'm not an investigative reporter, and I cover politics, right? So, for instance, we normally on this show, most weeks, the All Things Politics show for you guys is not about a terrorist attack. It's more about the ebb and flow of politics. And so there are only those, Earl's right. There are those investigative reporters who are covering, let's say, this story in Boston, who maybe have the up-to-the-minute information, but most of the rest of us, including those of us, that are journalists, don't have much more information than anybody would see, right, just by flipping on CNN. And that's one of the challenges of covering a story like this. It's easier for me to fall back on the politics of it. It's easier for others to talk about the law enforcement aspects of it. I would say, in defense of the media in general in this case, I'm not sure what facts would not be of what facts in the case we wouldn't expect to have by now, right? I mean, it's only been a week. There's been a couple of shootouts. There's been a bombing. There's been a ton of other news. They've got a suspect in custody. We know as of this morning that he's communicating with interrogators. It would be hard to imagine what other information in this particular instance we could possibly expect to know a week later. That doesn't negate Earl's point, though, about the fact that the media is changing, and a lot of it is commentary. A lot of it, I'm sure many of your listeners watch either Fox News cable shows in the evening or MSNBC cable shows or CNN cable shows. shows, and it is mostly commentary. It's not a lot of investigative reporting, and that is the landscape right now. But social media, just to make one final point, I don't think it's so much a venue. I don't look at it like something like Twitter as a venue that is in of itself a journalistic organ. I think of it as sort of as an aggregator or a microphone that amplifies what journalists are already doing. So in other words, I'm fairly active on Twitter, and in my Twitter feed, I follow the New York Times, the Washington Post, the National Review, Mother Jones, and I'm getting those stories delivered to me on Twitter, right? Just like anybody is. Not that Twitter itself is sort of a media outlet. That's how I look at it.
In terms of the scramble for facts and for being first that happened as things were unfolding on the ground, would anything have changed that? I mean, newspapers probably wouldn't have changed that land grab for facts that we seem to be seeing at that time for cable networks especially, would it?
Well, I think those of us who are old enough to remember the pre-internet days, I think the difference is that there wasn't. I think I'm answering your question here. The difference is that there was a time when there just wasn't as much time pressure to be first out of the gate. Newspapers have always wanted to, so to speak, scoop each other and be the first out with a story. It's just that the time parameters have shrunk so much because of digital media. So in past times, when a newspaper said, hey, there's a big story, there's been a terrorist attack in Boston, we've got 24 hours to get the story and get it out in the morning paper, well, now they've got like an hour. Right, to be the first, maybe that's an exaggeration, but they've just got a couple of hours to get that story and get it out because there's such a saturation of coverage, and I think that's the difference. So, yeah, newspapers have always been part of the grab. It's just that it's moving so, so much faster now. The news cycle is so intense for every form of media.
Well, we thank you, Earl, for your comments, and we go next to Pat joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I want to push back on Paul. That was somewhat, saddened and outraged me at the same time. I believe it might have been Jim. I always have a problem with the folks that want to blame America for terrorist attacks here in other Western democracies. They seem to never talk about what force for all the things that America has done for other countries to liberate them from dictators, fascist regimes. We can talk about World War One, World War Two, all the way up to AIDS research and treatments in Africa. And I guess collateral damage in a war where we're trying to root out Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which, because of their ideology, simply wants to attack us for who we are, is a lot different than blowing up civilians. And I guess for a guy like Jim, my question to him would be, number one, next time I read about an American blowing up anybody, I guess, in another country, then we can talk a little bit more about moral equity between those acts and collateral damage. Specifically to his point about oil, that talking point to me seems to not hold true either, because every time I hear about we're going to war for blood for oil and all of that, it certainly doesn't pay off at the gas pump, and we're still paying millions and billions of dollars to rebuild these countries. So why isn't the oil revenue paying for that? Why isn't bringing down prices at OPEC? If we're going to pillage these countries for energy, then why aren't we seeing the effect of that? And I just think it's an absolute another line of crap that these, the blame America folks like to perpetrate on this country. And my suggestion to them would be, if they don't like this country so much, why are they here?
All right. Well, thank you, Pat.
There, Veronica?
Yes, yeah. You may, please.
So even though I actually myself pushed back a little bit on Jim's earlier call, because I think it would be tough to justify these kind of, attacks like the Boston attack. Let me take the opposite view here in responding to your last call. I'm sorry. I lost his name, but
Pat.
Okay. So I think you stated the case fairly well, but I think that there's a couple of things that I would point out there. When you said, I'm sorry, his name was what again?
Pat.
Pat, I think you stated your case fairly well. But for instance, Pat, we were just talking about, you know, what's the last time that that Americans blew up civilians overseas? But that in fact does happen, right? We have drone strikes overseas, and civilians are killed. I would not make the case. I happen to think our drone program is actually. I'm one who would defend our drone program, but that doesn't mean I don't acknowledge that civilians, in fact, do get blown up in the process of going after terrorists in various countries. So I understand the point that you're making. At the same time, I would say that I would have a hard time calling Jim the blame America crowd, because there are instances where American actions overseas do generate a backlash. Whether it's justified or not, I think is the point where I would take issue with Jim. A couple of points that if I could, Veronica. So one is this idea that this is the whole challenge of the global war on terror. Again, I'm using that term for lack of a better one, where we seem to find ourselves now a decade, at least officially in a decade, but probably much longer, in a war against a stateless, Islamic government in exile, and right that moves from country to country and has different terror cells and different motivations and objectives, and these questions are so tough because we're not fighting a conventional war against a conventional nation state. So you have a situation where you look at a terror suspect and you say, are they an enemy combatant? Was this more conventionally a crime, and it hinges on whether that person's a U.S. citizen, whether they were apprehended here or apprehended abroad. And so I think the idea that any of these questions can be clearly answered without any equivocation, I would push back on that. I think that to Pat's point, to Jim's point, I think that there's certainly a situation where you could say, hey, it's not simply that Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups around the world just want to attack us for no particular reason. I don't want to be a spokesperson for Al-Qaeda, but I think they would probably articulate some reasons why they think the U.S. has, acted as an imperial power. Whether you buy into that or not, I think that's what they would say. On the other hand, I think I would, to Pat's point, where I think Pat has made the strongest point is that, the problem with this idea that there's a nexus between what the U.S. has done and what the response, if you will, has been, is that the response is not addressing a particular problem. In other words, my critique of Islamic terrorists over time has been, what are they expected to gain? In other words, the U.S. doesn't occupy any country other than Afghanistan at this point. And Afghanistan is a country from which we were attacked. So, and prior to 9/11, we weren't occupying any Islamic country. So the idea that terrorism is somehow going to accomplish a political goal, well, what was the political goal that Islamic terrorists were going to address by killing people? And I think that would be my critique. Before I cut myself off here, Veronica, let me just say, though, that we don't even know if there's a tie between Tsarnaev and Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. or Tsarnaev and Chechen militants or whatever. It's all still coming out, and I think that's why this stuff is so vexing.
Right. Well, this conversation between Pat and Jim, and these two phone calls, we may just be getting to have this conversation again, as we've had it before in the past, as these events happen, as Jahar Tsarnaev gains consciousness and starts to tell us more. I mean, when you speculate, I know it's dangerous to speculate, but with what he might say, what do you think where do you think this conversation could go, depending on what we learn as he speaks more?
I think it's going to be, if he's able to speak more, or if he's willing to speak more, I'm speculating here, but I do have a sense from the coverage that we've all seen that his older brother was sort of leading the plot. But I can imagine because of his background that there will be some connection to you know, an ideological view, perhaps an Islamist view. But those are all loaded terms. I mean, I just saw on 60 Minutes last night, right, he had some college friends who were Muslims from the Muslim Student Association at his school who were saying, boy, if he had come to prayer with us more often, he would have learned that what he was doing was crazy and not in any way representative of our religion. So, at a certain level, Veronica, I think that if this winds up being related to an Islamic ideology, then I think my guess would be that you look at a teenager committing this crime, you have younger people who become disaffected for whatever reason, maybe having nothing to do with ideology, and then they reach out for an ideology because it justifies their anger. Mm-hmm. their frustration, rather than there being this sort of logical link between murdering people and some political objective. And but we don't know. I mean, I want to reiterate that I'm speculating as much as anybody else because we don't know yet.
Yeah, it's just these are weighted conversations that we start to get into, and we had them after September 11th, and I think we'll just keep on having them as we move forward. And we are going to take a break right now during All Things Political. I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this morning, of course, we're talking about the Boston Marathon bombings and what may happen as we move forward, both with the investigation and as a country in terms of healing, in terms of how we process this kind of thing, and also looking at how this may intersect with immigration reform as well when we come back. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's All Things Political this Monday morning, and our guest is David Swerdlick, who covers national politics for TheRoot.com, a part of Washington Post Digital. And David, I want to talk about immigration reform. Something else on our mind last week got a bit overshadowed, but talking about and thinking about now how that may intersect with the Boston Marathon bombings and how that discussion might get reframed. How do you see that changing things?
Well, you already see a couple of senators. For instance, Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa, Republican from Iowa, has already come out and said that because of, in the wake of this attack, maybe we need a more of a go slow approach on comprehensive immigration reform. I think Senator Coates from Indiana also expressed similar sentiments yesterday on the cable talk shows. So you do have this idea in the wake of the Boston bombings that, wait, hold on, maybe we're moving too fast on immigration reform. Again, I would put this into the category of a certain degree of political posturing. I mean, there are legitimate arguments pro and con in terms of comprehensive immigration reform. Certainly, it's not clear to me that the immigration law that's being contemplated right now would have played that much into a situation here where you have guys who, prior to the Tsarnaev brothers, who prior to coming to the United States didn't particularly have any kind of terrorist profile, and whether or not they would have been more heavily scrutinized upon coming to the United States. It's been widely reported that the FBI interviewed, at the request of the Russian government, apparently interviewed the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, in 2011. But that was after he was already here and already had a green card. So, again, I think senators that want to slow the process down will certainly be able to make their arguments. It's not clear to me what those arguments are yet. I do think that it's just as a pure political matter, if you think about how this shaped up, things were going to be slowed down just because there's been so much news in the past week, right? Just two Sundays ago, Senator Marco Rubio from Florida went on 7 different Sunday morning talk shows as sort of the lead spokesperson, lead mouthpiece for the so-called Gang of Eight senators who are working on comprehensive immigration reform, as a Republican, as a prominent Latino politician, making a case for moving forward with comprehensive immigration reform. And then the very next day, there's a terrorist attack, and it sort of wiped that whole push right off the front pages. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be slowed down at a minimum because of that.
What is the concern when we hear about senators wanting to slow it down? What is the concern that moving ahead more swiftly is going to create?
Well, I think the point that's been made so far is that if you have potential immigrants coming from countries where we know that there's sort of a higher level of terrorist activity. Let's say the Tsarnaev brothers were from the Chechnya region. I think they were Chechen ethnically, but maybe had lived in Dagestan or Kyrgyzstan. I'd have to check that. But because those are tumultuous areas, there are places in the Middle East. Let's say you had people who wanted to immigrate from Yemen or from Syria. I'm picking countries where we know there's a lot of violent activity. They're saying, hey, let's apply more scrutiny to people immigrating from those countries. And I'm not sure that anyone on either side of the political aisle in Congress really would dispute that. I don't think there'd be much dispute in Congress from Democrats or Republicans if things were added to this legislation that said, hey, if you're from a country that's on a national security watch list, then there will be additional protocols in terms of background checks and additional interviews, additional documentation asked for. I don't think that would be that controversial. But the reality is that most of the comprehensive immigration reform debate is centering around countries where we've got a heavy flow of immigration from countries that really don't have this kind of activity that we're talking about. We have a heavy flow of immigration from the Philippines. There is Islamic terrorism in the Philippines, but it's something that's more in the background from the U.S. perspective. We've got a lot of immigration from India and China and from Latin America and Europe. But this idea that you're going to slow this whole sort of big solution down because in a couple of hot spots you need to do more scrutiny, it seems more like a political angle to me, because I think you could easily just increase the security protocols when you're talking about interviewing people, let's say from Chechnya. Sure, add an extra layer of Justice Department scrutiny on those visa applications, and I think that's as much as you can expect, unless you're just going to shut down immigration altogether from those countries, which I don't see as being part of a final bill.
Did you hear that Lindsey Graham quote that was reported this morning about how this is the time to bring the 11 million, into the light so we can scrutinize who's actually here right now?
I actually did not see that quote yet, but I think that's one of the underlying philosophical ideas behind comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, we know we have anywhere from 10 to 15 million people here without the appropriate documentation. You can call them illegal aliens or undocumented workers, what have you. The point is, we know we've got X millions of people here without the proper legal status, and it's not like I think I actually heard Senator Rubio say on TV the other day, it's not a hypothetical. The people are already here. So unless someone is proposing that we gather all these millions of people up and remove them, the idea is to get them, as Senator Graham said, out of the shadows. I think the debate ultimately hinges on this idea of, one, this idea of, will these people be a benefit to our economy, or will they be a sort of a burden on our economy? And I think there are arguments on both sides of that. And then there's the cultural aspect of this, which is that you're talking about an increasingly demographically shifting country, and you accelerate that process of making the American body politic more diverse when you legalize millions of people from around the world.
I want to go back to the phones now, get a few more calls in before we run up against the top of the hour. So here is Wayne joining us from Annawa. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
You know, the oldest brother, Tamerlan, they say he was so religious. Well, he must have had a cleric, or he must have attended some mosque here in this country. And what my concern is, how come the Muslim clerics don't ever seem to come out and condemn these acts of terrorists by some of their own people? And then my last issue is the sympathy toward the 18-year-old Zakhar here. All you had to do is look at the video and see where he walked up behind them little kids and planted the bomb and then walked away, and the next day put on the Internet how at peace he was with himself. I don't think he deserves the sympathy. That's all I have.
All right. Well, thank you for the thoughts, Wayne. David?
Yeah, no, Tsarnaev, the younger guy, the 19-year-old, he's a suspect at this point. But if he's convicted and found out I've committed this crime, which, you know, it certainly the indications are pointing toward him at this point for all the reasons that your callers have stated, there shouldn't be any sympathy. A 19-year-old is an adult, regardless of, you know, the fact that we know that 19-year-olds sometimes are guilty of bad judgment. You know, that we treat people, you know, if a 14-year-old can be, you know, tried as an adult for shooting someone in a liquor store holdup, then certainly a 19-year-old college student can be held accountable for setting off a bomb that kills three people and maims hundreds of other people, no question. In terms of the question about Islamic clerics, I think that's a tougher one, and that really gets to the heart of what we were talking about before the break, right, is that we are in this, you know, societal upheaval where you know, there are ideologies involved, there's religion involved, you cannot justify murdering people, and at the same time, you know, the politics of this is so complicated, I think it's hard to just say, oh, these clerics should just be, you know, speaking out and condemning this as if they were themselves responsible for it. I do agree, though, with your caller, that this problem probably will not make progress until more, as some are like to say, you know, moderate, nominally pro-Western Muslim leaders, Muslim clerics, speak out and say, hey, this isn't a representation of their religion. Their religion, you know, is not interested in you know, waging guerrilla war or committing murder, et cetera. But it's a slow process. I think you can hear from callers, you can hear from citizens, everybody, that how frustrating it is that we are, you know, 10, 12 years on from 9/11, and it feels like the discussion has not reached a turning point yet. But you know, these things, I think, turn very slowly. I will say that, back to the journalism point, there are some, maybe not the majority, there are some Islamic clerics who do condemn this violence. They probably don't get the press that they otherwise would, because it's less sensational for someone to come out and say, hey, we should have peace, we should have, you know, understanding, we shouldn't kill. That's not fodder for cable news in the same way as people who preach hate, and that's unfortunate.
You know, when events like this happen that we all share in as a nation together, and you see the suffering on your television, you read about it, and, you know, you feel it, because lots of this, you know, on my neighborhood listserv alone, there were lots of people worried about runners in the marathon that day. You know, it hits home, and you want something to come out of it that is more than just, you know, the horror and, you know, the angst and the fear. What do you see that could come out of this that would be constructive moving forward?
Well, I think there are a few positives. One is the law enforcement angle. I mean, if a week ago, I think people would have been shocked if they had been told, okay, by the end of the week, one of the suspects will be dead, one will be in custody, we will have, you know, brought a certain degree of closure to the investigation. I think there's a positive in terms of the way law enforcement handled it. I also think that there's a positive in terms of the way Americans now react to these situations. In other words, you know, even though I was pointing out some of the political posturing of politicians, it was relatively little, right? A few people said, oh, they should be treated as enemy combatants. A few people are now talking about, you know, this vis-a-vis immigration. But mostly, I think people were just pleased that the FBI and the state police and local law enforcement work together, and they're working toward a resolution, and I think Americans that are outside of Boston are proud of Bostonians, that people didn't panic, and, you know, people worked together and showed some resolve. And I think that's encouraging for the rest of us in the country that aren't in Boston, and it reflects well on people that are in Boston. To your question, Veronica.
And we're about 10 seconds left.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, then, I think that's really the takeaway.
I know. Yeah. Well, thank you, David. Thank you so much for joining us this hour. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. Enjoyed it.
David Swerdlick covers national politics for TheRoot.com, and that's a part of the Washington Post Digital. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.